Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 69, section 8. We got a little ways into the section. It's on old single column, page 779. It's the sixth paragraph, paragraph number 6, the one that starts with "Slavery was an indispensable link." And so before we jump into the middle of the section there, let's do a couple things. First of all, recall that we're going through these final four sections of this paper that hit upon four key elements in the establishment of civilization. The first one that we did was just that very rudimentary issue of fire, and then the domestication of animals, and now we're in slavery, and then we'll do private property. And as they were laying out their initial thoughts about, or their initial comments about slavery, the issue of slavery, recall that they were trying to get us to be objective about something that's very difficult to be objective about in this day and age, when we have as much spiritual consciousness as we have just naturally, not to mention how much it might get amped up by social tendencies to, you know, sort of further a bias towards your unity consciousness. This is a very poignant opportunity to challenge yourself to have an individuality consciousness that's equal to your unity consciousness, equal magnitude, and to leverage off the relationship between the two, follow it up to an objective perspective where you can look down upon something as difficult to think about objectively as an issue like slavery. And we're going to be starting with the paragraph that is the key paragraph that they were trying to give us as gentle an on-ramp to as they could. Remember some key issues that they brought up. Like, for instance, you know that eventually you have to get to farmer. You know, you start with hunter, you move to herder, and you have to get to farmer. You have to get to agriculture in order to have the stability that significant civilization can be predicated on. And so they were pointing out that you know you've got to go through those steps, and guess what? That is inescapably going from no slavery to women as slaves to full-on slavery. It's a very challenging sequence to consider when they throw in that little twist. It all seems so benign to go just from hunter to herder to farmer when you say it like that. But when you add in that parallel that is perforce bound to that sequence, that challenges your spiritual consciousness. But you're doing this in the absence of any significant technology. It requires a lot of energy for farming to be a significant phenomenon. You know, we're not just talking about a few vegetables in your backyard garden here. You know, to have a full-on farm that's feeding you know, thousands of people, that requires a lot of effort. And if you don't have gasoline-powered machinery, you know, how's it going to happen? You know, animals are doing some of it, but you know, we all know there's a limit. I mean, you can't have cows go out and pick cotton. That's not going to work. Someone's got to pick cotton by hand. You know, until you get a very sophisticated technology that can build a machine that can pick cotton.
Put Velcro on the cow.
It's, you know, they were trying to give us, you know, those introductory thoughts, and then they're going to give us the full-on statement. You may recall I was stressing it at the end of the preceding session that one has to not only recognize these facts about slavery, but that these facts about slavery are on every world. Slavery is a universal fact, you know, passing fact, yes, but a universal fact on every evolutionary world. Every world has to go through this process by this same means. And so they're about to make that definitive statement about how important this is to civilization moving. And I'll explain exactly where it fits in that process here after we read this paragraph. So let's get this paragraph under our belt and then talk about it here.
Slavery was an indispensable link in the chain of human civilization. It was the bridge over which society passed from chaos and indolence to order and civilized activities. It compelled backward and lazy peoples to work and thus provide wealth and leisure for the social advancement of their superiors.
Yes. All right, so let's deal with the politically incorrect second half there in a moment. But let's just start with, I bring this up all the time, and we've found the first of the set of four, the four indispensables. There are four indispensables to the progress of civilization. Okay, note how precise I'm being. Right. You know, narrowing it, there's indispensables for a lot of other issues and whatnot, reasons. But to that specific issue of the progress of civilization, when you're talking about early civilization, there are four indispensables. When you're talking about advancing civilization, there's four additional indispensables. But this is the first of the four indispensables for the progress of early civilization. And look at how they word it. You know, you can see you've got this sequence. You know, they're using the analogy of a chain of links. You know, so it's an indispensable link in the chain of human civilization. So they specifically bring up civilization. And notice where it is in this in the various stages of progress. It's right at the beginning. It's what gets civilization to begin to progress. Okay, that very strong statement that it was the bridge over which society passed from chaos and indolence to order and civilized activities. So it is this indispensable beginning of progress, genuine progress of civilization. Not just society or your culture, you know, and maybe there's civilization, but it's mostly a superconscious phenomenon. But civilization becoming a phenomenon that involves a significant degree of conscious human activity. Yes, it's very primitive and whatnot in relative terms to light and life, yes. But nonetheless, you know, you've gone beyond, you know, primitive man only thought when he was hungry. Yeah, there's some other things where he's got to be thinking. Okay? This isn't just going to...
Did you say modern man or primitive man?
Primitive man, you know. Yes, well, yeah. Remember, you know, what we call modernism is actually primitivism. So, modern almost always is in quotes these days. So-called modern man, yes, is technically primitive man. And postmodern man is pre-primitive man. But, yeah, so slavery, war, social classes, profit motive. The first one is slavery. See, they have them in that order for a reason. I mean, that's the order you find them as you go sequentially in the book. And see, they're in this developmental order. First is slavery, that first indispensable. And it is a very difficult indispensable, as I was just saying a moment ago, for someone of this day and age to think about objectively. And it doesn't help in terms of challenging us when they say things that are so politically incorrect to us these days as it compelled backward and lazy peoples. What happened to all men are born equal? Right, compelled backward and lazy peoples to work and thus provide wealth and leisure for the social advancement of their superiors, i.e. there are inferiors and superiors.
Pass the flammable
right.
Well, the first slaves, you remember, like, I think of it as like the ones that built the pyramids, you know, that was like five.
And of course, there were slaves way back before there was recorded history.
Yeah, sure.
Right? It goes all way, 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 way back. Yes, I mean, to your point, once you start thinking about slaves in an agricultural mode, the gears are turning. It's like, well, you know, there's other ways we could use this. You know, what if we want a massive building project or something like this? So, it expands beyond. But as they're trying to point out, I mean, the key thing that's inexorably moving you to quite universal slavery for a period on a planet is agriculture. Now think about on a normal world where you have an Adam and Eve that bring in science and technology, and after 25,000 years have a very advanced technology on that planet. So like in our world, at 10,000 BC, before our recorded history, I mean, slavery would have been way in the rearview mirror. Yeah. So, now of course, if you had Adam and Eve, there would be recorded history that went back a lot further than 6,000 BC, But still, just to kind of keep it in perspective.
And so with global warming.
Yeah, I mean, a whole bunch of things, right? I mean, you know, they tell you, you have a technology in the wake of 25,000 years with the Adam and Eve on a planet that, you know, is basically complete dominance of the physical world. So we're a long ways away from that. And we're just barely past the point where the only way to do things was with slaves. You know, we've only just in recent times been able to replace slaves and animals. Yep.
It's a little strange in my view. We still have backward and lazy people with cell phones. And it adds to the craziness of how some stuff has come down. Now we have this technology with that same problem that was happening then.
Right.
They don't mesh very well.
Yes, we haven't, we've in general, you know, at least in the, you know, the spear point part, you know, elements of civilization, we've left slavery behind, especially in terms of agricultural use of slaves. But we're still genetically not very advanced, and there's an awful lot of us that are on, you know, the lesser tail of the bell curve in terms of abilities, and Achilles heels, unfortunate tendencies that can be taken advantage of, and we can be easily fostered into a very indolent state.
That's how I see it.
So that problem is still there. I mean, there's, take it out of the slavery and notice the word compelled. Because of the way we are genetically, if not socially as well, there are going to still need to be things that compel us. Cattle prods, because we just are not going to initiate and maintain this on our own. There's way too many of us that are susceptible to various detrimental states, like the salubrious climate or whatnot, and just getting lazy. And we all are pain avoiding, we're all indolent. If we can find the path of least resistance, we're on it.
Pay good money.
Are we kind of staying on the level of feelings all the time? Emotions?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's very difficult to get above the level of the feelings when you have this sort of limited self-initiating genetic character. You sort of naturally get up to the level of feelings, and it starts to become more and more unnatural to go above that. And there's not that many people that have that ability to transcend their naturalness and push themselves up. So they're going to have to be pushed up. So we love to imagine that we can leave the initial four indispensables behind, slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive, and move on to those wonderful second set of four. But we're, even the leading edge of civilization, so-called civilization on this planet, is a long ways away from not needing a pretty sharp cattle prod to push us forward. Okay, so and again, we have to recognize, especially when we didn't get all of the biologic guidance, we didn't get the biologic uplift, we didn't get the guidance into blending into one race from Adam and Eve. We have a very, very broad spectrum, horizontal spectrum of humans on this planet. Lots and lots that just, they're not capable of very advanced self-initiated phenomena. So in that sense, there are inferiors and superiors. Now, obviously, the moment that you have any genetic sort of leg up, it's immediately your responsibility to not let it go to your head. Right? Remember one of those five favorable conditions? Humble. Right? A limited individual is kind of naturally humble.
Yeah.
Right? You give an individual a little bit to work with, and pride usually soon follows.
Out of my way.
Right?
So,
physically, mentally, you might recognize you have some, quote-unquote, superior attributes that you began with. But to him whom much is given is much expected. So the challenge is to be able to use words like inferior and superior and not think of those spiritually. You're spiritually equal. There's not one shred of vertical differential in the eyes of the Father. He's no respecter of persons. Okay. But physically and mentally, there's a huge difference across the planet. Okay, so see, that's the challenge. I mean, that's, see, you know, the fact that that sentence is, or that paragraph is so politically incorrect, that's just a reminder of how unbalanced our culture is, how we've enculturated a bias to our unity consciousness. We don't approach issues objectively, and hence we don't approach any issues wisely. Hence, there's a growing emergency on the planet that led to the reason, yeah, this book being in my lap. So, as some people have heard me say, you know, the next time you think that some politician has said something controversial, just pause for a moment and imagine that politician stepping up to a microphone, pulling out a little slip of paper, and reading this paragraph. Okay? And that'll help you to keep things in proper perspective about exactly how controversial what that person just said really is. And there's many paragraphs or sentences in the book like that. It's rugged truth. We need to get more objective about just what challenging thoughts really are compared to what, you know, we're supposed to be outraged by, which is actually, you know, many times it's not an outrage at all. It's actually a very wise statement. It's just in contrast to the totally ignorant culture that it's set in, right? I mean, wisdom is now an outrage, right, in our culture. So just, you know, everyone, you know, just keep that in mind, you know, that, you know, you don't want to follow the herd on, you know, on what's supposedly politically incorrect. Okay, so there you have it. Our first of the four indispensables for the progress of early civilization. What else do they say here?
The institution of slavery compelled man to invent the regulative mechanism of primitive society. It gave origin to the beginnings of government. Slavery demands strong regulation, and during the European Middle Ages, virtually disappeared because the feudal lords could not control the slaves. The backward tribes of ancient times, like the native Australians of today, never had slaves.
You know, at the end, they remind you another example of what we were saying. You know, you go back far enough, and, you know, when it's basically a hunter society, okay, you don't have slaves. Even when you're well into a herder, you don't have slaves. What else do they give you there? So you notice again, they're stressing how this is at the beginning of significant progress relative to civilization. You know, invent regulative mechanisms. You know, gave origin to the beginnings of government. So this is it. This is why it's so indispensable. It gets a number of these elements going. You know, and we can all say, well, I don't know. I mean, every regulation I've ever seen or every government I've ever seen is horrible, so I think this is a bad thing. Well, no. Okay, just because there's unfortunate government doesn't mean there can't be better government. You know, the fifth epical revelation is trying to teach us the truths of government so that we can either recognize for the first time or remind ourselves of things that we've forgotten about what it takes, what kind of philosophic objectivity it takes, what kind of wisdom it takes to have a government that isn't, a net negative phenomenon in our lives. It doesn't happen naturally. Naturally, a government is going to be a net negative. Right? If it's going to be net positive, there has to be definitive, human, artificial, unnatural, conscious choice in play, establishing and maintaining that positive, unnatural state of affairs. Otherwise, it'll just material gravity just drags it down into the laws of the jungle, and that's not pleasant. Now, what are they talking about? You know, when they say that, you know, during the Middle Ages, slavery virtually disappeared. You know, in Europe there. You go, well, wait a minute. I thought, you know, in a feudal system, you had serfs. Aren't those slaves? You know, I mean, you have to appreciate the difference. You know, they actually mention it in the next paragraph. When the Redditors are talking about slaves, they're talking about unwilling servitude. Serfs, that was willing servitude, right? I mean, everyone, you know, the vassals and the serfs and, you know, under the lords, I mean, everyone was willingly putting themselves into this hierarchical system. You know, one of the main reasons was for safety. You know, that security age stuff, you know, to be under the protective umbrella of the lord, or the overlord. You know, so you're taking an oath. You're not being, you know, you're taking an oath that to go into this role, you know, of binding yourself to the land, like a serf is, you know, really becoming just, you know, an appendage of that plot of land. You're not, you know, so much the property of a person as you are, you know, a feature of the land as a serf. And you've willingly stepped into that role. You know, it's, you know, going to be a lot of hard work and stuff, you know, and you're way down in the, you know, in on the bottom of the peasant totem pole, but you know, you're going to get some protection from the hordes, you know, that would kill you otherwise. And so that's, but they're pointing out, see, when, you know, things broke down into that system, you just didn't have you couldn't maintain the complexity of a regulative structure to make the slave thing work. Because obviously when you have unwilling servitude, there has to be a lot of rigorous structure in play to keep that all nailed down. All right, so that's what they're referring to there. Okay, well, then you give us an additional little piece here.
True, slavery was oppressive, but it was in the schools of oppression that man learned industry. Eventually, the slaves shared the blessing of a higher society, which they had so unwittingly helped create.
Unwillingly.
Yeah. And unwittingly, yeah. Slavery creates an organization of culture and social achievement, but soon insidiously attacks society internally as the gravest of all destructive social maladies.
Okay, so they're just giving you, you know, these initial statements, and they already have gotten to the point where all good things taken to extreme become bad. You know, you grow out of this quickly, and, you know, relative to going from first humans to light and life, right? It's a short passing phase. But it's an indispensable phase nonetheless. I think I mentioned this last week, what they're pointing out there. You're oppressing these people. It's unwilling servitude. But you're forcing them into an environment where, by osmosis, if nothing else, they'll start to pick up, you know, the qualities of a more civilized culture. You know, they'll slowly, experientially begin to get this. You know, like when we think about colonialism, you know, it's treated as an absolute negative, you know, in this day and age. You know, but think about, you know, what they just said there. Same is true of colonialism, you know, and And some of those people in those former colonies, you know, that are can be objective a little bit, they say, well, you know, yeah, we were oppressed a lot during the colonial times, but at least the trains ran on time. Because they recognize, you know, we just can't keep the trains running on time ourselves. We just can't be that rigorous. And you know, they recognize there's some genetic issues. I mean, the only place that you really have any significant civilization on the planet is where you have some significant biologic upstepping. You get a little bit of that biologic, you know, Andite biologic uplift, that Andite blood into northern China, and guess where the civilization in China is, you know, centered? Not in southern China, it's in northern China. Same way with India. It's not in southern India, it's in northern India, etc.
Those changing.
Yeah, I mean, without that that biologic uplift from Adam and Eve, without that increased engagement of the seventh adjutant naturally to a people, and then hence an increased encirclement in the Holy Spirit naturally, it's very difficult for a people without that to initiate and maintain anything very sophisticated. You know, you teach them a whole bunch of things about how to, you know, some better food processing techniques, but the moment you turn your back, you know, they go right back to what they've been doing for the last 200,000 years. You know, it's very difficult. So, you know, those are some facts that they're trying to get us to face, and, you know, between the lines of just talking about slavery directly. You know, this, you know, it's just how politically incorrect is it to even say something like schools of oppression?
Right. You better have bulletproof.
But like they're saying, see, and it's slow, it's a very slow process, but eventually, so you notice they do that eventually. There's a long evolutionary process of that they're in association with, and eventually it starts to sink in, and you know, they begin to recognize, as they're saying, the blessings of a higher society, you know, and they challenge themselves to follow suit. Many on the planet can follow. Well, that's why, you know, there's never been more than 1% of leaders in any given generation. You really don't need any more than that. I mean, just you need a few people that can initiate and maintain just internally on their own integrity, and it doesn't have to even be 1%, and everyone else can follow well if they haven't adopted Luciferian thinking. You know, you're not the boss of me. I'll do any damn thing I want to. I'm not going to follow you. You know, okay, that's a problem. But assuming that they're willing to recognize leadership and follow it,
I've got a few teenagers like that.
Yeah. And if they don't learn by looking, they will learn by leaping, unfortunately, assuming they make it through it.
True.
Many of us, you know, look back and wonder how, you know, but for the grace of God, you know. Right. Yeah. Our ignorance is pretty profound when we're young. Okay, so unwilling servitude, yes, but positive. There's a positive side. But as soon as that eventually is reached, you can see, then you need to be transitioning away from that, because now it's going to transition to a net negative. And you're going, oh, okay, I get that. So, you know, I think we're there. Let's change now. So they add another paragraph. What does it say?
What do you want? Fill in the blank?
Modern mechanical invention rendered the slave obsolete. Slavery, like polygamy, is passing because it does not pay. But it has always proved disastrous suddenly to liberate great numbers of slaves. Less trouble ensues when they are gradually emancipated.
Okay, so first, you know, the initial little thought there, you know, that profit motive. That's another one of these four indispensables. And see, and you know, it's not idealism. It's not a motivation predicated on ideals. Let's say it that way. That's the main driver to this transition away from slavery. You know, it doesn't pay. Ask Solomon how expensive it is to have all those concubines and wives and stuff, right? You know, he had to basically, cut down every tree, in the entire Middle East, building houses for them. Bankrupted the entire area. So as they're pointing out there, it's all these very rudimentary things that just inexorably drive us, these four drivers, these four indispensables, push us forward. And then you see the wisdom that they're trying to bring in there, that second half of that paragraph. It has always proved disastrous suddenly to liberate great numbers of slaves. So, first of all, remember, they're not just talking about here. They're talking about on every planet in the universe of universes, trillions of examples. Okay? It has always proved disastrous. And they're not even using the word disastrous. As I've pointed out a number of times, think about the literalness of that word. It literally means apart from the stars, i.e., apart from the cosmos. If you try to liberate the slaves too quickly, it's an all good things taken to extreme become bad situation, you literally produce a situation where what cosmic quality your civilization has is disrupted, shatters it, and you're probably going to end up way back having to start over again on a number of things. It's going to be so cataclysmic to that holistic quality of your social system. It's going to lose that relationship to the whole, to the cosmos. They very purposely bring in that word when they want you to think about, the sweeping consequences of that are involved, much more than you would imagine. Less trouble ensues when they are gradually emancipated. And, I mean, this has, been in the news just recently. This issue has come up. What do we want filled in blank? When do we want it now? When that crew thinks about slavery, if someone suggests that we could have ended slavery in the United States through a gradual evolutionary process, they're called a racist. No, they're called a wise person is what they're actually called. They're someone who recognizes if you do it too fast, you'll actually disrupt the cosmic quality of the civilization.
Yeah. Are you saying it's still too fast, though?
Well, it ended up being, in some ways very, very fast. In other ways, you notice that we tried to do it really fast, but it didn't, it actually took until the 20th century, to work through a number of things. Because again, you can try to go against the cosmos, but you have to be very aggressive, driving things to iniquity to actually go against the cosmos is a difficult thing to do. So it's not surprising that you didn't work through some of these issues until the middle of the 20th century. 100 years later. Yep.
Less trouble.
They say no trouble. Yes. Right. There will be trouble. A lot of it is just, especially when you don't have the guidance of, normally you would have the prince and his staff guiding the people about what methods and how, what speed to transition out of slavery. They would get some guidance. Some wisdom from above, but we're just shooting in the dark. But you know, the problem is when you don't think, you know, you think of this as an existential evil.
You judge everything by today.
Yes. Yeah, not to mention judging it by today. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it ends, it leaves you in very ridiculous states of of mind, where you're saying that it would have been horrible. It's horrible to even suggest that we could have done some compromises and stuff, and had a gradual transition out of slavery. It's like, no, it had to be a war. Okay, so you're saying that war is the only way to eliminate slavery. I thought you said that war is good for absolutely nothing. Now you're telling me it's the only way to eliminate slavery. That it's existentially wrong to eliminate slavery by any other way. What are you saying? I mean, you just have these absurd self-contradicting minds. You know, they don't recognize that they're believing opposite things in within themselves. So, yeah, the revelators are trying to lay this out. Everything is an evolutionary process. You have to think in evolutionary terms about everything. The only thing that you can change on a dime is where you're sovereign, your inner life. Everything else is the Titanic. It has to turn very slowly. If you turn the external world fast, what's that called? Revolution. Rebellion. That's what Lucifer wanted to do. He wanted to turn things fast. It's like, we know where we want to go. Why do this slow banking turn? Why not just turn it 90 degrees? Right? That's the rebellion. Thinking that you could, you know, that it's appropriate to turn something like that. The only thing that you can turn, you know, remember revolution, what the word means, you know, like the earth revolving around the sun. Right, that turning, you can impose a turning, a complete 180 degree turn inside where you're sovereign, but you're not sovereign out in the external world where those slaves are. That's not your sovereign domain. You don't have a right to say, forget about the Supreme. The Supreme doesn't know what he's doing. Let's do it like this. So, you know, if you want to use that, you know, what do you want? What do we want? Fill in the blank. When do we want it now? You know, it's all only about you that you can. What you fill in the blank is, what do I want? A more cosmic inner life. And when do I want it? Now. Choose this day to put the cosmos first in the inner life instead of yourself. You can do that. In an instant.
Well, it takes practice.
Right.
You can initiate it.
The decisions don't all immediately follow suit, right, yeah. But the choice that overarches the decision, the potentializing, can be done just now. Okay? I consecrate myself right now to as quickly as possible getting to a state where I never fear again. I know, you know, the part of my body, part of my mind is attached to my body, and my body are like the Titanic, okay? There's some inertia there. I can't turn it on a dime like I can the upper domain, right? But I can potentialize the rest of it turning. If I turn the upper domain, everything else will eventually follow because the upper domain is superior. It's dominant over the lower. The lower has... you know, doesn't have any choice, right? Only the upper domain has choice. But the lower domain doesn't have choice. It perforce must follow.
But it's a... you may not achieve it right away.
But it's a physical phenomenon, has inertia. So it doesn't just right. Turn on a dime, but it will turn. Inexorably, it will turn. As long as you choose, genuinely choose, you know, bind yourself to eternity, a constant changeless state, you know, impose that changelessness upon your temporal mind. Okay. And as individuals turn right? Naturally, we manifest outward, and the external world will turn too. It'll all happen in a natural evolutionary way within, you know, moving out through you and then out into the socialization of the individuals. And eventually there will be no slavery. But you won't do this revolution thing that has a great possibility of making things worse than when you started. Eventually you need to eliminate, you know, colonial systems. But if you just do it like that, you know, the whole bottom drops out and, you know, and you descend into very chaotic states. All right. Let's see, anything else that we need to stress? You notice some of the qualifiers, you know, suddenly to liberate great numbers of slaves. See, they're not saying that you, you know, there might be, you know, some small, you know, groups that, you know, but just to think in you know, in those false unity terms, you know, where you're thinking as a universal thing, you know, every single slave is going to be freed tomorrow. You know, there's just no wisdom in that. Right? There's no recognition of the differentials of individuals. Some, you know, some of them are right on the, you know, the cusp, ready to be liberated and can, you know, and become leaders of those who will be liberated subsequently. You know, you can begin that process. You know, and there's definitely others that are, it's better for the stability of things for them to stay in servitude for a while. I mean, I often, you know, very politically incorrectly say, you know, that what we need these days is a lot more indentured servitude. I mean, there's a lot of people that have way too much time on their hands considering what's going on between their ears. It's a problem for the rest of us that they have such a social consequence that they have time to, you know, to weigh down the civilization as much as they do.
We have a tendency to think of all slaves as being rescued and passionate for independence and freedom and liberty. And I suspect, especially before the universal bestowal of Thanatosers, many slaves accepted their lot with equanimity.
They weren't that unwilling. Many were basically not really slaves, but serfs.
Yeah.
You know, it was a willing thing. You know, I mean, maybe initially as they're being hauled over here from Africa or something, you know. But once they kind of get, it's like, well, I can work with this, you know. They're not champing at the bit. So just like those Europeans during the Middle Ages, they're going, well, you know, it's, you know, it's not the life of the Lord, but it's a life. At least I'm alive. we have to recognize that those differences. And all men are not born equal. Okay. Now what do we get here?
Today, men are not social slaves, but thousands allow ambition to enslave them to debt. Involuntary slavery has given way to a new and improved form of modified industrial servitude.
You gotta love that. Quote unquote new and improved. a little tongue in cheek there.
I think they mean it.
No,
slavery is
Slavery 2.0. Yes. There's a number of things like this. You're not, instead of being forced into an unfortunate state, you choose to be in that unfortunate state. Freedom is, you know, a tricky thing. You know, when you have to make decisions for yourself, do you have the wisdom to make decent decisions? Yeah, remember that's the fundamental experiment of going from a monarchy to a republic like the United States. You're assuming that the citizens have enough internal integrity that you can take that step. You know, that they can, they're capable of at least some decisions that aren't self-destructive. You know, and don't just have to have a king who's well-educated and wise and just tells them, you're going to do it like this. You can kick and scream, but you're going to do it like this. You know, and of course, that's breaking down. You know, more and more people, you know, you give them a little bit of freedom, and you know, they're their own worst enemy. They're very self-destructive. You know, you give them the lottery winnings, you know, and they end up with a life that's 10 times worse than before you gave them the lottery winnings. I mean, even those that earn money on their own often use it to destroy themselves. You know, even they have enough, you know, wherewithal to actually generate wealth on their own, but they don't have the wisdom for it to be a lasting positive, you know, especially when you go to the next generation. The children often destroy themselves with the wealth of the parents. You know, it's a very difficult thing. So the whole issue, you know, it's interesting that you read this since you brought this up, you know, the whole bit about enslaved to debt, yes. Yeah. You know, and you can't help but think about things like, you know, I owe my soul to the company store, right? The line from that old song, right? I mean, you know, easy credit is a very problematic thing.
Yeah, now that we're enslaved in debt, it's going to be disastrous if we all got out of debt. Mm-hmm. All suddenly.
Yeah, see, and that's the thing.
We'd all sit here and say, well, we'll take it.
Yeah. But your point is, yeah, we have to recognize we get ourselves, you know, we've gotten our civilization in a very tenuous state. We can't think about just snapping our fingers and magically getting out of it. We're going to have to slowly work our way out of it. You know, it's evolutionary process got you in, and evolutionary process has to get you out. You don't want to try to make some radical change, at least not too sweeping. You may have to do some minor things in a pretty significant way, but you got to do that very wisely, knowing what things you can push a little harder and what things you got to let, you know, just be an incremental or almost no change at all, right? So that you don't upset the system, because everything is all connected. It's an elaborate system, you know, that we have. So let's see. To Shane's point about, you know, they didn't put new and improved in quotes. Right, again, what did I just say? It's like, you know, I don't know, maybe what we need is more indentured servitude. there are some.
I think they mean it too, yeah.
Yeah, see, you know, there's a, you know, that, you know, they're hinting at what I was just saying there. I mean, some need to be, you know, have less freedom. They'll just be a destructive influence to themselves and everyone around them if they're given enough rope to hang themselves. So it's actually sort of just an expression of the natural state that we're in genetically, that you kind of just went from one form of slavery to another. See, it's just kind of reminding you that technically slavery still is indispensable.
In all its forms.
Yeah. See? We haven't totally gotten out of that. Where the only way for civilization to kind of be stable and inching forward is to have some degree of servitude, you know, involuntary servitude. It's a sad thing for your ideals, but it's the state of affairs.
Talking about those other people.
Yeah.
Getting really close to home.
Yes, yes. Yeah, lest anyone think that that I'm not talking about myself here. Yes.
But you're a serf.
Anyway, okay, another little tidbit they throw in here.
While the ideal of society is universal freedom, idleness should never be tolerated. All able-bodied persons should be compelled to do at least a self-sustaining amount of work.
You know, yeah, see, they didn't put it in quotes. What is the following paragraph? Yeah, it's exactly what we were just talking about. You know, the contrast between an ideal and an idea. See? The ideal of society is universal freedom, but if you try to make that your idea, that's disastrous. That's self-destructive. That's social suicide. Okay? To think that you can apply that idea directly, or that ideal directly as an idea. Now you're striving towards that, and you know there's we already touched upon that back at the beginning of the paper. He who will not work shall not eat. All right. If that it has to be some way compelled against you. They're compelled. That's a very basic way to compel someone. It's a very foundational hunger, food hunger. He who will not work shall not eat. And you notice they brought in.
Yet they're building a building out here for the people who
won't work, yeah. And they're going to feed them and house them, and yeah. See,
they say in some other part that that's one of the mistakes that churches make.
Right, right. I mean, and of course, churches.
That's politically incorrect.
Churches are just a society in general. I mean, our government, everyone is doing this. We all we all know that this is part of the emergency. That we think this is appropriate. To establish pauperism, right?
Is that for youth,
though?
Is it for youth?
Yeah, I mean,
that's different, right?
Well, yes and no. See, I mean, again, you've got to be very discriminating. I mean, it's one thing if they can't work, but you notice what they said: able-bodied, right? I mean, they're telling us we have to be pretty tough love, about this. I mean, if they're able-bodied at all, right, you can't tolerate idleness. They're going to bring that out in the next section. It collapses civilization. Setting up poor people as a complete lifestyle solution, pauperism, where they don't have to worry. Charity is just going to give them everything they need. But obviously there are those that need help. But you have to discriminate. You only help them to the degree that they can't help themselves, and you have to challenge them to help themselves the rest of the way.
About the thing in the parking lot, right next to us here, I believe that they're going to be having training that's required, and they will be required to be working.
Yeah. I mean, we are slowly, over the last few decades, it isn't as hopeless as it might seem. We've learned by leaping that some of these notions of trying to apply the ideal directly don't work. But it's still an upstream battle. There's an awful lot of people that refuse to bring in any pragmatism. They're pretty certain that the reason that it failed before is they weren't zealous enough about making the ideal the idea. And so there's still a tension. There's a lot of people that would love to reverse all of the pragmatism that we've brought into welfare. Yeah. That kind of started getting into play in the 90s. There were a lot of people that loved to reverse that and make it, all men are born equal, there shouldn't be any strings attached to anything. There's a lot of voice for that. So,
how does that song go? Money for nothing and chicken.
Yes. and of course, you think something is expensive now, wait until it's free.
It's a bumper sticker.
And that's, you know, like I said, we're going to get into that in the next section. That's between the lines here. They're hinting at that issue they're going to bring up in the next section about idleness. You know, and just how strong that idleness should never be tolerated. Very strong. And that's just not politically correct these days. okay. And then they give us kind of a little wrap here on what we've, a little summation of what we've been going through in these three sections here that we've just, we're finishing up here.
Modern society is in reverse. Slavery has nearly disappeared. Domesticated animals are passing. Civilization is reaching back to fire, the inorganic world, for power. Man came up from slavery by way of fire, animals.
Came up from savagery.
Excuse me, savagery, by way of fire, animals, and slavery. Today he reaches back, discarding the help of slaves and the assistance of animals, while he seeks to wrest new secrets and sources of wealth and power from the elemental storehouse of nature.
So see what they're trying to get you to recognize about the fundamentally reflective nature of genuine science and the consequent technology. You have this very natural sequence of going from fire through domestication of animals to slavery, building up to where you have the wherewithal to have a scientific civilization, and you have the individuals that are human enough, consciously now, to be reflecting enough to step back and say, you know, there was an element, pardon the pun, and where we started, that we could go back, and instead of just sort of playing with it naturally, getting what you can get out of it naturally, we could go back to the elemental storehouse of nature and begin to tap into it unnaturally, as an artistically engage the natural world, and begin to make it personality managed. It doesn't release all of its potential naturally. The potential that God has stored in nature can only be fully released unnaturally through personality management.
Like it's a negative.
Oh.
Well, that last part, does it? But he's reaching back.
Yeah.
Discarding.
Well, right. See,
he's going the wrong way.
No, he's not going the wrong way. See, he's being born again. He was born in fire and moved forward through domestication of animals and slavery. And then he's born again.
Behold,
all things are becoming new, you know. And not to mention going, you know, beyond, you know, just, you know, stored up carbon reserves and things like that. But, you know, getting into nuclear power and even deeper, tapping all the way down to ultimatonic level eventually,
fire.
You know, for energy.
Right.
Well, I mean, just tapping into the deeper potentials inherent in matter, like a star does. You know,
so why does it say he's in reverse then?
It's
not a negative?
Right, it's not a negative.
Okay.
I
always thought it was a negative.
Yeah, you're turning back, okay, the literalness of reverse. You turn your thoughts back to where you started. And you say, you know, you could go back to where we started, and you go, oh, God started us there for a reason. He was telling us that that's where it's all at, really. And all of this domestication of animals and slavery was just scaffolding to get to the point where we could look anew at where God started us and see the greater potential there in that basic elemental fact of the world around us. You know, and tap into chemistry, and tap into physics, and use our reflective powers to unravel the secrets of what matter is, and how you can actualize those latent potentials in matter. So, you have to do this internally too. That's why I brought in the whole born again thing. You move up through the levels of meaning in the lower domain, okay, and you are born again as a spiritual individual. You started out as a material individual in the lower domain, and if you keep going up into that relationship with genuine unity, genuine spirit, and then keep going up and re-individuate as a spiritual, you know, child of that spiritual father, be born again, you don't leave that lower domain behind, you go back to it, and behold, the lower domain is becoming new. All things in the lower, you take a hold of that lower domain that served as scaffolding to get up, but now you take a hold of it and make it personality managed. You do the same thing internally that they're telling. See, you turn back. You know, it seems like, you know, you're going up. It's like, I'm just going to keep going up and up and up and burn all the bridges behind. No, you go up. And then you turn around, you know, you reverse your gaze and you look back down into the lower domain and you begin to take a hold of it and master it. Just like you look back to this developmental sequence of the collective, right? And you go back and you take control of it. Now, eventually you're going to have to take control of the animals too. You know, it's going to be more than domestication. You're going to establish complete dominion over the animal kingdom. You know, like is on an architectural world. There aren't, you know, renegade carnivores on an architectural sphere. Right? Those animals are totally controlled. They've been genetically, to get to that, you have to genetically modify the evolutionary animals to get them to that state, where they can be compatible with a world of enlightened life. You know, Tyrannosaurus Rex is not compatible with a world of enlightened life. You know, and neither are millions of bison trampling, you know, the gardens of Edentia.
I thought you were going to say mosquitoes.
Right? I mean,
mosquitoes aren't.
Yeah, not to mention annoying things like mosquitoes and whatnot. But appreciate there's the parallels here.
I mean, so domesticated animals are not herds; they are animals that were used for work.
Yeah, like right. You're domesticating them to use them
to do work
as a source of energy.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha. Right? So, but it, you know, I've always read this when it says modern society is in reverse. As being, you're going the wrong way. Has anybody else thought of it that way before when you've read it? I mean, as opposed to now you're saying...
See, if they were...
It's not really saying you're going the right, it's just...
You're just turning back, you aren't going back. It's not, it doesn't say modern society is in retrograde. It just says reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And, see, and it's just a... Like I said, I mean, it's in the mind. You aren't literally dragging everything back to primitive state. See, it's in the mind. Internally, you're looking back. You're reverse. You're turning back. You know, the literalness of that word. You're turning your eyes back to where you started and seeing how you can... You have all this work to master the... physical world, master the animals, oh yes, and even master mankind, right? The genetic engineering of mankind. I mean, one of the reasons why you had slaves is because you had all these lesser individuals, you know, that really weren't capable of initiating civilization by themselves. When a world is enlightened life, every single person, you know, is able to initiate advanced civilization in and of themselves. No one is being drugged along anymore. See, so you have to go back and go through those elements, again, only take a hold of them top down as a managed, personality managed phenomenon and master them. Master the physical world, master the animals, and master ourselves biologically.
Yeah. Can we visit this planet when it's in light and light? Since we won't get to
experience that. You know, technically, you know, you could. You know, you may be way off on other things, you know, but...
Would you be able to...
watch it?
No, you know, just consult the...
Yeah, you can definitely look up in the broadcast, you know, what's going on.
Well, it's going
to
happen after.
Of course, you know, if you've already made it to, you know, into the core of the finality, you know, you can't come back to the seventh super universe until you've done the other six.
It's not going to take that long.
Half of
the planet will be in light long before we get to the core.
I think so.
But, yeah, so starting out at the
bottom. Just all those technical things, you know. But, the contrast between prograde and retrograde compared to...
This is this negative one. Saying,
yeah, it's not. It's
physics.
See, just like it's not negative to look back at yourself, the self is not evil. The self is an uncarved block of marble. You know? And you need to become an artist and carve it into something worthy of eternity.
Right?
Well, that's why Jesus saw, you know, so much potential in every person. That's why he was able to, something that we can't always do. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, you know, and even, you know, it's like one of the indispensables in advancing civilization's prayer. Prayer is self-reminding, right? You're up in the upper domain, you know, in a significant way, but you are, prayer is a part of your life where you look back and are reminded, okay, of that self and the work that needs to be done there. But you don't try to build that better self. You know, see, that's where the analogy about the marble breaks down a little bit. Remember, the actual carver is, you know, the god of evolution. You know, you supply the favorable conditions, you know, through which you can be grown into a mastered self. You don't build a mastered self. But you potentialize that mastered self by, I'm determined to be loyal. I'm determined to be humble. I'm determined to be sincere, etc. You know, you consecrate the favorable conditions like that, and eventually yourself will be a mastered self. It will have wisdom, knowledge, courage, and focus on the four levels of meaning below the fourth. The third, second, first, and zeroth levels of meaning. You'll have a mastered self. And when that fear has been totally turned into focus, you fear not. See, so, you know, what Jesus was saying is you need to set your sights on that state where you fear not, where you have a mastered self all that's penetrated in reverse all the way back down to the zeroth level and has mastered that. And it's not fear anymore. It's a focusing mechanism in your mind. You know, it gets your attention focused, you know, in a very sharp, definitive way on where it needs to be focused.
There is no fear to fear.
But there's no negative emotion, you know, related to that. Right?
It's not always easy in today's world.
Yeah. The spirit, if you will, the spirit of fear is focus. You know, eliminate all the animal stuff. And just get the core essence of it, that focus. That's a mastered self.
Logical acumen?
What was that?
Logical acumen?
And then your logical acumen, which needs that definitive point, the word acumen means point, the more you have a self that can be brought all the way to a precise point, the more there's a conduit for that logical acumen to penetrate down to. See, you're making yourself conform to that precisely focused human potential of that logical acumen, that bringing the synthetic whole to a point of recognition. If your mind is just a wash of diffusing eddies, how can you bring, you know, that logical recognition to a point of focus in that? You can't. Right? You remember what they say about your adjuster? Your adjuster would like to do something, put a little precise thing in there, but as soon as it does, you just go, you know, and disperse it to the four winds. You know, you don't have a mind that can hold a focused thing like that. You know, I mean, the adjuster, to work well, needs a mastered self. And it's not going to master yourself for you. That's your job, not the adjuster's job.
There's a little input. Yep. I'd rather be called an uncarved block of marble than a fancy animal. That made you keep that in mind.
Right. I mean, all right, in actuality, you're a fancy animal, but in potentiality,
you're an uncarved block of marble.
Right, yeah.
There's a finality in that block.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, whether or not you're focusing on your actuality or your potentiality, right? On the fact of yourself or the truth of yourself. Fact, you're a fancy animal to a large degree. But in truth, you're much, much more. You're the most magnificent uncarved block of marble in the cosmos.
Finality
in the rough.
I wonder what
color. Yeah. And so is
everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. All right. Private property.
Yeah. Right? So this fourth element is a big element. Private property. Let me just say up front, because it comes up as you go forward in these civilization papers. Private property is a very foundational element to have any sort of sophisticated civilization. You can't get. You can't really get from tribe to nation without private property, you know, let alone to territorial state.
And as you well know, in some of the Middle East countries, you know, private property is non-existent. You know, they're not allowed to have it. So you can see it's tribal and hasn't gotten to that.
Right. We all know, because of this broad bell curve that we have, you know, we've got people that are way back, you know, and some of these ancient states have gotten fixed in stone by religious dogma, right? They can't evolve because humans are keeping them from evolving because they think they're innately divine, you know, in their primitive state. You know, private property is evil. Oh, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like just primitive people. That sounds like so-called modern people. Yeah, yeah. Right, of course, we're going to get that right away here in the first paragraph.
9. Private property. While primitive society was virtually communal, primitive man did not adhere to the modern doctrines of communism. The communism of these early times was not a mere theory or social doctrine. It was a simple and practical automatic adjustment. Communism prevented pauperism and want, begging, and prostitution were almost unknown among the ancient tribes.
Okay, so, you know, you can kind of see that in a way, you know, technically you didn't have communism, you know, in a social doctrine sort of a sense, you know, as the ideal that socialism is striving towards, you know, a la Karl Marx. Okay, you know, let alone thinking that we can just take the ideal and apply it as an idea, you know, so-called modern communism. But you had a natural communal state of affairs in that very primitive society. It just, naturally starts out in that sort of oblivious common mode. It takes a more advanced individual to express that definitive individuality of personality. Without that, there's going to be a tendency to kind of just pool into a sort of a lowest common denominator. Okay, so that's the initial quote-unquote communism that you have naturally. It's a simple and practical automatic adjustment. Like I said, I mean, there's no thinking and theorizing here. It's just, and it starts out, okay, with some positive elements that you don't get into, being poor is a complete lifestyle solution, pauperism, right? And want. You don't have the difficult societal issues of begging and prostitution. But it's only a net positive for a short period of time. And then it, as they're going to point out, it becomes a negative thing. Okay, what else do they say here?
Primitive communism did not especially level men down, nor did it exalt mediocrity. But it did put a premium on inactivity and idleness. And it did stifle industry and destroy ambition. Communism was indispensable scaffolding in the growth of primitive society. But it gave way to the evolution of a higher social order because it ran counter to four strong human proclivities.
Okay, so before we go into each of those four, notice the word indispensable is here. Okay. But it's not civilization, right? It's society, and primitive society at that. Okay. So it's not one of those four indispensables to the progress of early civilization. But as I was just pointing out, it starts out as a net positive, this sort of just automatic, unwitting thing. Like they're saying, there's no theory here, and so you're not saying, there's this hierarchy, and that's bad. All men are born equal, so we need to level everyone down. I mean, no one's thinking foolish thoughts like that. And you're not exalting mediocrity. You're just down there, in that that lowly estate where you begin, naturally. You have that initial fact of a group that is a positive thing that is you're leveraging off and getting you going. But as they're pointing out, even though it didn't have these false doctrine notions, it did put a premium on inactivity and idleness. So in relatively short order, this is going to become a societal ill. Those who are taking advantage of the magnanimity of this common, context. It's like, well, this guy he loves to work, and I don't really. So why don't I just lay here and with my mouth open, and he'll drop, food into it occasionally. That gets old for the guy that's working like a dog every day. that very initial sense that a child has comes to play. It's like, wait a minute, I don't think that's fair. Right? You don't see the mutuality that you expect. See, they're pointing out it quickly becomes problematic because even though it helps to have a group to kind of get things going, it immediately becomes a problem because everyone gets awashed into the group, into the commonality, and that's de-emphasizing personality. Personality requires definitive individuality to express.
And as you mentioned earlier about Karl Marx, in our lifetime we've had some, you know, huge examples of communism in, you know, throughout a lot of Asia, etc. And how you can see how it's that the truth of this has played out.
Exactly. And and just see, notice the very corrosive fact is it did stifle industry and destroy ambition. See, it's depersonalizing. You know, of course, we all know that there was kind of conscious depersonalizing going on. Everyone needs to wear the same gray outfit, and you know, all these sorts of things. You know, so that's the corrosive thing. These primitive persons kind of get the group going, but immediately they need to be in charge. They can't become helpless victims to the commonality of the group, or they are going to lose their personality. Okay, and so it's these four personal drives or nagging desires that just couldn't be suppressed that break it. You know, so they go through these four elements here.
One, the family. Man not only craves to accumulate property, he desires to bequeath his capital goods to his progeny. But in early communal society, a man's capital was either immediately consumed or distributed among the group at his death. There was no inheritance of property. The inheritance tax was 100%. The later capital accumulation and property inheritance mores were a distinct social advantage. And this is true notwithstanding the subsequent gross abuses attendant upon the misuse of capital.
Right, so, I mean, they all know about how, you know, we contrast communism and capitalism. You know, they're trying to remind you about, you know, to use the overused expression, the baby bathwater thing. Okay? Don't think of capital as a complete lifestyle solution. Full-on mindless capitalism. Okay, but capital, you know, an element of society that is of the head, right, the literalness of the word capital, is obviously very important. It's a human quality, to be thinking in areas except when you're, you know, beyond when you're hungry, you know, like we've been pointing out. Capital is a result of human reflective thinking, foresight. So you notice that's the fundamental thing here in play. It's like, well, no, I see my family as a people of the future. I see a thread of truth going through me and my family going into the future, and I want to foster that. And you're saying no? You're just going to burn everything when I die, you know, or cast my pearls before swine?
Then why should I do anything?
Right. Yeah. Right. See, so it assaults some of those rudimentary human sensibilities. You know, and that's why those who tried to establish communism by force in recent times knew they had to, you know, they had to try to suppress the human nature of people. I mean, just make them by force just fancy animals, and maybe not that fancy, right? Because if you let any personal nature out, see, it's going to unravel it just like it did in primitive times. You know, you're not going to stand for that as a human. Only an animal can be, you know, a drop of water in the ocean like that. Okay.
Two, religious tendencies. Primitive man also wanted to save up property as a nucleus for starting life in the next existence. I didn't know you could do that.
Call my bank.
This motive explains why it was so long the custom to bury a man's personal belongings with him. The ancients believed that only the rich survived death,
with any immediate pleasure and dignity. The teachers of revealed religion, more especially the Christian teachers, were the first to proclaim that the poor could have salvation on equal terms with the rich.
So look, you know, how they're pointing out, you know, you're kind of thinking, oh, we're talking way back, and then they say, well, actually, the Christian teachers were the first, right, to really challenge that established belief. Okay, now you're going, now, like you were joking, it's like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. So even if the notions are silly, you know, ignorant and superstitious and whatnot.
Today.
But you know, the whole point is there is, you know, don't look at the conscious things that are being done, but recognize it's genuinely religious. Yes, it's all super conscious, you know, in terms of its literal religiosity. But nonetheless, see, there's that human thing. The human is, again, he knows that there's more to them than just the immediacy of the moment, right? And they know that their life has meaning that just can't fit into a lifespan, right? That there has to be an afterlife. There has to be something that goes on, no matter how primitive your notions are about that. Right? You're just not going to let this no private property thing thwart that expression of that yearning for some kind of a religiosity, you know, to be expressed. So again, like I was saying, it's these human proclivities in contrast to the animal proclivities, right? No matter how primitive those human proclivities are in their expression, nonetheless, they're going to break this fact that technically only animals are going to stay together in that commune. Humans aren't. Humans are going to be champing at the bit. Notice again, you've got the whole issue of property, like they're, you know, what this is all about is, you know, is the driver, you know, as we think of material stuff as having all these problems, like, well, yes, you know, like they said, you know, this is true, notwithstanding the subsequent gross abuses attendant upon the misuse of capitalism. Okay, yes, but again, this basic connection to matter that we have ends up driving us out of getting locked forever in this primitive state of primitive communism. And the degree to which a so-called progressive thinker thinks there should be 100% inheritance tax or close to it, see, they're not progressive. They're retrogressive.
I was going to say greedy. But...
Well, there's also that, thou shalt not covet, you know, and they're not thinking about that, yes. You know, between coveting, you know, thy neighbor's, you know, property, as the Ten Commandments told you shouldn't do, you know, and just thinking that the ideal lies clear back in what's actually the very beginning, you know, sort of pre-civilization. You know, like I said, I mean, it goes from so-called modernism, primitivism, to so-called postmodernism, pre-primitivism, right? I mean, you know, it's another example. You know, where you actually think that, you know, it's very advanced when actually it's the most primitive thing that you could impose upon yourself.
Yeah. Okay. This last part was one of the things, you know, that Paul stressed in his letters to the Romans is, mm-hmm. You know, the poor shall inherit the earth just like the rich.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was a step forward, I think, in terms of
it's a difficult step because, of course, you're having to do what Jesus didn't have much success in doing, getting people to recognize that there's spirit in contrast to matter, and he's not your material father, he's your spiritual father. So all these issues of wealth and whether, you know, your pleasure in the afterlife, none of that's relevant, you know. But it's been very difficult for people to think of those issues in spiritual terms.
If they think about them.
Yeah, you know, if they think about them at all, yeah.
Okay, three, the desire for liberty and leisure. In the early days of social evolution, the apportionment of individual earnings among the group was virtually a form of slavery. The worker was made slave to the idler. This was the suicidal weakness of communism. The improvident habitually lived off the thrifty. Even in modern times, the improvident depend on the state, thrifty taxpayers, to take care of them. Those who have no capital still expect those who have to feed them.
Ah, yes, I shouldn't have to explain that one very much. Mm-hmm. Right, you can see how apropos those comments are, you know, and how much people believe exactly false from what's true. You know, it's 180 degrees false from the truth. And we clamor mightily for the imposition of this falsehood upon our society.
Notice I say expect those rather than humbly thank those.
And you have a right to expect.
Yeah.
Right? You know, you're told it's your right. You have a right to expect those who have to feed you. Right? That's your right. Right? Ah, yes. See, you know, bringing that word right, you know, existentializing it like that. And again, you know, remember what improvident means. Not.
Provident.
What? You know, improvident is just like foresight. Right? It's the same word. You know, no foresight. Those with no foresight. That are just fancy animals. They're functioning as a fancy animal. They don't have that human quality of foresight. So you see in all three of these, see, it's that foresight thing. Remember, they stress that. That's the rudimentary human quality, you know, in contrast to the animal. You know, the sha-la-la-la live for today crew, right? Those are the fancy animals. You know, and we've exalted that, you know, until you have a right to sha-la-la.
So it's an animal rights question.
Yeah, fortunately, it's an animal rights issue, yes. To put a point on it. Yeah. See, and again, even in modern times, you're going, well, so-called modern times. See? Yeah. You know, and of course that, you know, gets into statements like, you know, the fundamental problem with socialism is eventually you run out of other people's money. Right? You know, that whole idea of lighten life via redistribution. You know, if we just redistribute enough all over the globe, man, then the world is just going to be, you know, wonderful. There'll be peace on earth and brotherhood among men. No, you'll have utterly nothing. You'll be so much worse than the Andonites ever were. It won't even be funny.
The irresponsible will squander it, and there won't be any wealth reposited anywhere else.
Right.
So where are you?
You'll just have absolutely nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
But there was one point about the thrifty taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
Their tax dollars, maybe mine.
Mm-hmm.
Include myself, should be used for the infrastructure for them.
Well, again, remember, you know, this gets off into the weeds of the technical elements, you know, the science of statehood, you know, the whole issue of what kind of taxation is appropriate. And, you know, like they point out, I mean, you know, you've got light and life taxation notions being attempted to be implemented during the material comfort era, which are just completely destructive ideas.
I guess I know what you're talking about.
Income tax. But yeah, that gets off. You know, remember we touched upon that when we went through, you know, talking about the planetary mortal epochs and stuff. You know, they bring up some of those issues of how we're getting, you know, we can visualize way in the future. You know, we're trying to implement those recognized ideals as ideas in the present. You know, and they're not positive when you implement in the present. They're destructive.
So what are you saying about the income tax? That's a bad thing.
Yeah. You shouldn't be taxing income.
But a lot is taken out of people's income, and that should go back to the infrastructure.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah, we don't want to go off in we'll actually get into some of those. We'll get into those weeds some when we do government on a neighboring planet. But, you know, we don't want to get too scientific right now. But just, you know, we'll get to that in the appropriate time. But just, you know, just recognize that there was some truths that were recognized when this country was founded that made it so it was illegal to have an income tax, right? Right, so you have to ask, did we go forward into a new enlightened recognition or did we go backward? You know, that we had to change the Constitution in order to implement that.
People are getting ripped out of their money.
Yeah, so it's just a, yeah. It's a very, very problematic thing to do in so many ways. Anyway, okay, so, all right, the whole issue of he who will not work shall not eat coming into play there again. You have to challenge people to do the best they can with what they have. And a gracious society will make up the difference, but only the difference. They need to take it as far as they can, and then if they need further help, okay, then we'll help, but you can't take it the whole way for them. All right.
4, the urge for security and power. Communism was finally destroyed by the deceptive practices of progressive and successful individuals who resorted to diverse subterfuges in an effort to escape enslavement to the shiftless idlers of their tribes. But at first, all hoarding was secret. Primitive insecurity prevented the outward accumulation of capital. And even at a later time, it was most dangerous to amass too much wealth. The king would be sure to trump up some charge for confiscating a rich man's property. And when a wealthy man died, the funeral was held up until the family donated a large sum to public welfare or to the king, an inheritance tax.
But see, so notice that again, they're pointing out, okay, it seems pretty crude, you know, very scheming, you know, individuals finding a way to work around this and liberate themselves from their bondage to the shiftless idlers. see, you notice that you're using that word shiftless. I mean, see, you can't shift them off of that just go nowhere animal state. You know, you can't get them moving. But see, that. You know, what you might just sum up in simplistic terms is the greedy, you know, broke communism. It's like, well, okay, yes and no. I mean, again, it's the material comfort era is powered forward towards the quest for knowledge and wisdom in part by the greedy, right? They are, they're fundamental to the energy of that progress through the material comfort era. And they're kind of
see that happening in our lifetime in China, Russia, places.
And they kind of remind you of that.
Falling before capitalism, actually.
Yeah. I mean, all good things taken to a screaming coming. You know, they keep reminding you, you know, like they said there, and this is true, notwithstanding the subsequent gross abuses attendant upon the misuse of capital. Sure, yes. But we have to recognize that there's no way. It's a lot like slavery. There's just no way to power things forward except with these very kind of crude drivers initially.
Yeah. Greed, if you really think it through, is more problematic for the greedy person than it is for everyone else.
Yeah, you know, they're kind of pointing out is, yeah, I mean, It's like, I'm going to stockpile gold. Well, that's all fine and dandy. How are you going to protect it from those that, you know, if things do really go downhill, everyone knows that you've got gold and they're going to be at your door and killing you and taking your gold. So it's, you know, it's a very difficult thing. Like you're saying, in later time, it was most dangerous to amass too much wealth. All hoarding was secret. You see, that, and you notice they're bringing up what I was just saying. Primitive insecurity prevented the outward accumulation of capital. And, you know, and you still have a lot of that. I mean, you know, there's a limit to how much you're really cushioning yourself against the collapse of civilization by hoarding stuff. I mean, you have to think about this in practical terms.
Bury so many gallons of water in the ground, and that's the type of hoarding.
Yeah, I mean, both you know, Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses have both, you know, developed in a similar sort of thought space, you know, have all kinds of plans that when everything else collapses and everyone else is, you know, can't sustain themselves, we can. You know, they've tried to establish a very self-contained system where they have everything they need unto themselves. And, you know, everyone else is going to be cleansed, but they will go on. Right? But, of course, you know, like we're pointing out, it's like, well, yes, but the hordes can be pretty aggressive. So, you know, anyway, you know, the media point here is just, so you have these four different proclivities, as they said, that just, you're, you know, like when they said desire for liberty, notice they said liberty, right? That's a spirit word, right? Not mere freedom, but liberty. You have a human desire for liberty that tries to manifest itself in the external world as some measure of freedom. But, you know, the sense of, you know, liberty burns, you know, very brightly in a genuine human. And you're going to have a hard time snuffing out that light of liberty in individuals and actually force them into a gray, featureless, you know, communist state, you know. Communistic regime. All right, what else do they tell us here?
In earliest times, women were the property of the community, and the mother dominated the family. The early chiefs owned all the land and were proprietors of all the women. Marriage required the consent of the tribal ruler. With the passing of communism, women were held individually, and the father gradually assumed domestic control. Oops. Thus the home had its beginning, and the prevailing polygamous customs were gradually displaced by monogamy. Polygamy is a survival of the female slavery element of in marriage. Monogamy is the slave-free ideal of the matchless association of one man and one woman in the exquisite enterprise of home building, offspring rearing, mutual culture, and self-improvement.
Just a little parenthetical there is hearkening to one of those four indispensables for advancing civilization, true monogamy. And notice that we have a very similar thing. We got to full-on slavery through enslaving women. This sort of limited treatment of women is playing a role in these early stages here, too. That women were sort of the most definitive, immediate expression of the fact of this primitive communism. That women were a common property. Now, you didn't have families. See, so just notice that. You know, see that whole... If you try to impose full-on communism, you're going to disintegrate the individuality of families. And they're reminding you that that will turn things back to an estate for women that women might not look forward to. So, again, when we don't understand, you know, what sort of is a naturally part of, you know, literal communism, we romanticize it as something that we should be striving for. It's like, no, that's a very primitive estate.
Even when you have full-on communism, you still have chiefs. You still have those who are more equal than anyone else.
Yes, right, right. So anyway, just, you know, note again that that's kind of an interesting little the way women fit into this this issue as well here. Let's see, anything else there I should stress? Again, that, you know, why did it transition from mother-dominated to father-dominated? See, again, it's just a natural part of this evolution out of this sort of indistinct mass into something that can individuate and be directed. You know, you can't direct sort of a formless blob. I mean, you have to bring it to some focus in order to direct it. So you have to nucleate the family. You know, you have to sort of draw that individuality out of the unity ocean, and then direct things forward. All right.
At first, all property, including tools and weapons, was the common possession of the tribe. Private property first consisted of all things personally touched. If a stranger drank from a cup, the cup was henceforth his. Next, any place where blood was shed became the property of the injured person or group.
All right, so yeah, very superstitious people. Yeah. So it starts out, and you know, but we still have shades of that. You know, if you don't want your brother or sister to get your, you know, the food, you lick it.
Yeah.
Now it's mine. All right, see.
If you really wanted to go after.
You notice that between the lines? Oh, that's where that comes from. I get it. Yeah, and then, of course, the whole fixation on the power of blood, you know, you can see coming into the superstitions there. Okay.
Private property was thus originally respected because it was supposed to be charged with some part of the owner's personality. Private property honesty rested safely on this type of superstition. No police were needed to guard personal belongings. There was no stealing within the group, though men did not hesitate to appropriate the goods of other tribes. Property relations did not end with death. Early personal effects were burned, then buried with the dead, and later inherited by the surviving family or by the tribe.
Okay, so there's that evolution there. But again, you notice how it's starting out in this very superstitious state. And you know, so think about the challenge of using the word personality in the Aranjabuq, right? When it starts out with something that, you know, material, you know, literal, materially, you know, conceived as it was charged with some part of the owner's personality. And just to appreciate that no matter how sophisticated we think we are, there's still shades of that kind of primitive thinking tied to the word personality. You have to challenge yourself to go a long ways to get to what the revelators mean by that word. Let's see. So you notice that you're powering the concept of private property is sort of in the same mode as fetishes. Yeah. See, so it's in that, you know, obviously the culture has a fetish concept, and you're sort of just transferring that into this, you know, concept of your rationalization scheme about the appropriateness or the literalness of there being private property. You know, it's not some spirit that's in it; it's your spirit that's in it. Right? So it's your private property. Okay.
The ornamental type of personal effects originated in the wearing of charms. Vanity plus ghost fear led early men to resist all attempts to relieve him of his favorite charms, such property being valued above necessities.
Right, so see, again, all these superstitions powering it, that the main thing for having ornamentation like that was to try to ward off the negative impacts of ghosts and spirits. Such property was valued above necessities. I mean, you know, you would give up all your food before you'd give up your magic charm. You know, you'd sooner face starvation than, the unmitigated horror of what the ghosts are going to do to you, right? A fate worse than starvation by 100 orders of magnitude. Remember how they said it was just this sublime terror, you know? Okay.
Sure saved on law enforcement
costs. Yeah, right. And the whole bit of taboos, you know, you didn't need, police forces or anything like that. Yep. Okay.
So, quick question.
Yep.
I think most of this was before the rebellion or after?
Well, both. It was being moved away over those 300,000 years with the prince's staff, but, almost everything went all the way back to the beginning. You know, as they're about to point out again, like they do so many times, many of these things are still totally in play in Old Testament times, so.
Sleeping space was one of man's earliest properties. Later, home sites were assigned by the tribal chiefs, who held all real estate in trust for the group. Presently, a fire site conferred ownership, and still later, a well-constituted title to the adjacent land.
That's pretty straightforward. I think we can just let that be and keep going.
Water holes and wells were among the first private possessions. The hole fetish practice was utilized to guard water holes, wells, trees, crops, and honey. Following the loss of faith in the fetish, laws were evolved to protect private belongings. But game laws, the right to hunt, long preceded land laws. The American red man never understood private ownership of land. He could not comprehend the white man's view.
So again, a lot of that's pretty straightforward. You see them, like I said, it's the fetish stuff is definitely in play. And notice another word there. They're challenging you. To get to what the revelators mean by faith, you have to recognize that it has nothing to do with a quote-unquote faith in the fetish. Right, that's belief in the fetish. Right, many times they'll use these words in that historic context, just to remind you of how primitive, basically the dictionary definition of the word is, okay, yeah. Compared to what you need to get to.
Surprised they needed a fetish to guard the honey. They had the bees.
All right.
Private property was early marked by family insignia. And this is the early origin of family crests. Real estate could also be put under the watch care of spirits. The priests would consecrate a piece of land, and it would then rest under the protection of the magic taboos erected thereon. Owners thereof were said to have a priest title. The Hebrews had great respect for these family landmarks. Cursed be he who removes his neighbor's landmark, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. These stone markers bore the priest's initials. Even trees, when initialed, became private property.
Yeah, so just, it may go away from initialing it to make it your private property, but you still initial trees. Right? The superstition can go away, but the practice remains. They're just trying to point out how many of these things they just become conventionalized and just go forward into the future indefinitely. And like I said, see, they bring up the Old Testament, to remind you how so much of this is unchanged to, very recent times. Let's see, anything else we need to I think it's all pretty obvious that we've got lots of superstition involved here, and lots of rethinking about what religion is and what priests are supposed to be up to.
In early days, only the crops were private, but successive crops conferred title. Agriculture was thus the genesis of the private ownership of land. Individuals were first given only a life tenureship. At death, land reverted to the tribe. The very first land titles granted by tribes to individuals were graves, family burying grounds. In later times, land belonged to those who fenced it. But the cities always reserved certain lands for public pasturage and for use in case of siege. These commons represented the survival of the earlier form of collective ownership.
I see. So that is a little thing you might not have thought about. It's like, oh yeah, we always talk about that area of the city as being the commons. I see. It harkens back to that. You know, it's the vestiges of communism in primitive form. So they're reminding you that they're, you don't have to have communism, but you can still have stuff that is in common. Common is not bad. It's just when you make it a complete lifestyle solution, it's bad. And notice you see how they're reminding you of how this is all parallel, how getting to private property is tied to going from hunter to herder to farmer, that agriculture is key in this genesis of the concept of private ownership. Okay.
Eventually, the state assigned property to the individual, reserving the right of taxation. Having made secure their titles, landlords could collect rents, and land became a source of income, capital. Finally, land became truly negotiable with sales, transfers, mortgages, and foreclosures.
And so again, this is a basic thing they're trying to remind you there, is how you, yes, it's not light and life ideals, but you're developing more expressions of capital, stuff that's of the head and requires people to be thinking in order to initiate and maintain those phenomena. You can't just be thinking only when you're hungry, right? So capital is very key to that, bringing some personal nature. Yes, it's very kind of limited, sure. But nonetheless, it's bringing some reflective thinking into play, even if it just has kind of material immediate ends in mind. Nonetheless, you're really thinking a bit about something besides your belly. Okay.
Private ownership brought increased liberty and enhanced stability. But private ownership of land was given social sanction only after communal control and direction had failed. And it was soon followed by a succession of slaves, serfs, and landless classes. But improved machinery is gradually setting men free from slavish toil.
Okay, so there's the science and technology coming in again, like we've talked about. Notice that we've had to rediscover some of these things, or we're still trying to rediscover. We have set up a number of things to be, owned communally, the downtown park. And then we discovered that no one wanted to go there because, you couldn't get within 100 yards of the bathrooms, for instance, or something. Right? So finally, the city relents and puts it under private ownership, and then it's wonderful. Right? You can eat off the restroom floor. We're just slowly having to rediscover what they discovered way back in ancient times. That there's certain things that need to be in private ownership if there's going to be anyone who's going to take care of them, Sure, they may falsely think that eternally this is theirs, this is my property, but at least they're going to take care of it rather than, well, this is not mine, who cares about it? I'm just going to throw my garbage all around the park. It's a very problematic thing that we're having to work through. What things should be held publicly and what things should be held privately? And we forgot the things that we figured out a long time ago that should be held privately, and we're having to rediscover this.
The right to property is not absolute. It is purely social. But all government, law, order, civil rights, social liberties, conventions, peace, and happiness, as they are enjoyed by modern peoples, have grown up around the private ownership of property.
Yeah, I was just speaking to that. Yeah, sure. Okay. The right to property is not absolute. Okay. We certainly have notions of existentializing this, you know, which is not true. But nonetheless, you know, it brings some order and integrity into situations that can't have it any other way at this state. We're just not innately profound enough beings yet to have something wonderful that is owned, publicly owned in a number of circumstances. It's just not going to happen. We're too primitive. So you have to give it to some person that, yeah, he may think it's, you know, he has it eternally, but he's going to take care of it. So it's okay. It doesn't matter what notions he has about it.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, we grew up well-versed in buying and selling, you know, go to the store and buy something. That's a simple transaction. But then you go to buy a house, and it's all this complicated deeds of trust and mortgages and this whole level of abstraction that's at first difficult to get your mind around because it's abstract.
Right.
It's not simple and straightforward.
Yep.
But it reflects a historical evolution.
Right. Yeah.
Not just something somebody dreamed up overnight.
Yeah, it isn't just some arbitrary oppression. Yeah. Yes, some of this stuff is, you know, gone too far. But there's an essence of truth, you know, in those regulative structures. You know, there's experiential wisdom. You know, people learned a long time ago. They tried it other ways, and it just did not work. You know, they recognized, no, you need more regulation here. You know, you just can't go into, you know, regulationism. You know. Okay, final paragraph here.
The present social order is not necessarily right, nor divine or sacred. But mankind will do well, to move slowly in making changes. That which you have is vastly better than any system known to your ancestors. Make certain that when you change, the social order you change for the better. Did I say that right?
Yeah. That you change.
Do not be persuaded to experiment with the discarded formulas of your forefathers. Go forward, not backward. Let evolution proceed. Do not take a backward step. Presented by a Melchizedek of Nebadon.
Okay, so, you know, we were just touching upon that. You know, that which you have is vastly better than any system known to your ancestors. There's experiential wisdom embedded in these things. You need to respect that. You need to reflect on them until you can see the truth that's flowing through them, you know, so that you don't just flippantly discard stuff that you shouldn't throw away.
There was no good old days.
Yeah. You know, also again, the admonition to move slowly in making changes. I mean, always, you know, don't do that revolution thing in the external world. And then, of course, you know, what's the section we're in here? You know what they're immediately thinking about with these two exclamation points. Right, all the so-called progressives that think that communism is the ideal of the future. Yeah,
the next thing.
Yeah, they're like, no. Right, you know, you're ignorant of the past. You think that's forward. No, that is the most backward thing you could head towards. So that's, you know, go forward, not backward. You know, there's nothing more backward than communism. You need to go forward through capitalism, i.e., you know, the abuses of capital. You got to go through the material comfort era and go forward. You know, not to mention let evolution proceed. You know, you can't grow this. It has to be growing in you. So you just supply the favorable conditions. Okay, I got to push it a little bit over there to finish that up, but I thought we probably should, because then we can get into the next biggie after slavery, and that's war.
War!
See if we can figure out what it's good for. we'll get into that next time. Much more politically incorrect stuff
to come.
All right, let's take a moment, everyone.